Welcome to the Damage Report. I'm John Iderola.
And I'm Ben Carollo, host of Galaxy Brain.
Yeah, I like that. I like that little intro. Ben's back, everybody. How awesome, how exciting is that? Just in time to comment on the rapidly developing war, the situation in Ukraine. And my God, is there a lot happening every day, including just some fascinating video. You know, I know you're a soldier. I am not, clearly. Briefly ROTC in college, don't think that counts. So anyway, this is like the window that I get into what's going on. We were talking before the show, Ben, and it's a lot to process. How have you been doing?
Yeah, I mean, like honestly, the news is overwhelming, and it's just like, I mean, like at a certain point, we just have to like intellectualize things. It's hard to like watch videos on the ground of like what is actually happening to people, because as somebody that has like worked with drones and like watched it happen in real time, like we all need to be able to take a step back. But even if we're like thinking about it and talking about it, there's ways to do that where you sort of like step away and just sort of like talk about it in a more sort of academic light to keep yourself from just completely losing your marbles about it.
Yeah. And even that might not necessarily be enough. It's a lot. And we're going to be going through a number of different updates in relation to that. But that's not all. Let's see, we've got candidates dropping out for really interesting affairs, not just regular affairs, really interesting affairs. We've got that. We've got students heckling an anti-trans politician. That's the thing that's giving me life today. So that'll be fun. And a whole lot more besides a bit of a scandal in the WNBA related to planes, and a lot more besides. So as we launch into this 90 minutes of fascinating news, please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already. And if you want to send us comments, tweets, super chats, all that, we'll respond as we go. But with that said, Ben, are you ready to do this thing?
Heck yeah, let's go.
Okay, well, actually, I'm not quite ready. I do want to, before we launch the video, I just want to let everyone know any video that we might show out of what's coming out of Ukraine could be triggering for a variety of different reasons. So everyone bear that in mind. We're never gonna show you anything too incredibly graphic, but that said, here's this. So thankfully, the man in that video did survive, although apparently just barely. That is about as close as an airstrike like that can get near to you without doing, well, I'm not gonna say without doing harm, because for all we know, he has been harmed physically and certainly psychologically by the experience. But that's an airstrike, a Russian airstrike near a government building in Kharkiv that happened just in the last probably 24 hours. And that is the experience that we just saw there that many are experiencing right now in Ukraine. There's another resident of the city said, "Today I survived a bombing. A Russian plane dropped a bomb on the house next door. My boyfriend and I were at home. We felt a strong whistle and I realized it was flying towards us. We were in the corridor then and we felt the explosion from there. As dust rose up," she said, "the first thing I heard was children crying. Our neighbors have three children, and the only thing I was thinking about that moment was, God, not them. Please, only not them." And the assaults specifically on civilians have long established in the conflict from the very beginning, apparently becoming more common. You can see in this map right here a number of different civilian structures being attacked by Russia just in the one city we're talking about here. Residential buildings, commercial buildings, as well as government buildings. All accidents, I'm sure, as in every conflict when that sort of thing happens, totally accidental. Nobody intends to do it, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, like, because this is really the thing, right? Like, I guess the one connection I want to make first and foremost is like, we need to understand the mental impact this has on people. So like, if you look at the United States military, people who work with drones actually have a lot higher rate of PTSD. And the reason for that is that it's harder to mentally disconnect the conflict from like your sort of normal everyday life, because people working with drones go back to their normal house afterwards. Now, this is people who literally their apartments are under attack, right? And so how can you walk away from this? Even after the dust has settled, how can you walk away from this feeling safe in your own apartment? And that is just the extreme mental toll that living under warfare like hits people with. And then talking about like the soldiers, the Russian soldiers coming in, it really seems like there was a lack of downward direction in terms of like telling the soldiers on the ground like what exactly the operation was gonna be. Now, obviously the invasion itself is completely unjustified and terrible, but like if you're doing an invasion and you aren't communicating and have strict control over what the soldiers on the ground are doing, there's gonna be a lot of this happening. And that really seems to be the case of what's happening, where they're not really keeping a tight control on everything that's happening on the ground, and it's leading to a lot of this happening. And so it might be one of those instances of sort of intentional accidents, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, and I could see that coming about as a result of decisions being made by people who don't necessarily understand the situation on the ground. Also by soldiers who don't have information about what's happening zoomed out from the area of the conflict they're currently in. But then also let's bear in mind, they come in there with this particular plan that they have been preparing for. They face a number of different obstacles. It doesn't go as planned. Is that gonna result in a little bit of desperation at either of those levels? Individual soldiers who suddenly find themselves in a very different situation than they were told when they were sent into Ukraine, or the military or political leadership in Russia that is, they're facing these economic sanctions, they're like being condemned by the entire world. Does that lead to a sense of desperation or a need to make gains potentially at whatever cost? That's my fear at this point.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you have this pressure for like a hurried pace, because right now these sanctions are hurting the Russian economy and there's this sense of urgency. And basically when you have a sense of urgency, you maybe have a faulty plan to start off with, and you have like a lack of sort of like a lack of like discipline, it seems, right? Obviously we're not Russian soldiers. We have no idea like what the day to day is there. Like those factors combine to create an environment where basically the more hasty you try to be, the more chaos there's gonna be. And under that chaos, people are gonna behave erratically, right? Both the civilians and the soldiers. And it creates a really, really terrible, miserable environment where things can get really scary really quick.
Yeah. Yeah. And these little videos, as tough as they can be to watch, are a view into that. Like imagine being that man, assuming he survives this conflict. Is he going to be able to hear planes flying overhead without thinking about the experience he's just been through? And God only knows how many other near misses there might have been just for that individual. Now he survived, many are not. One local official in Kherson said, "We cannot collect all the bodies and we cannot count, because there's just been so much bombardment of a few of these different cities." In fact, we're gonna show you a little bit of, so again, any map like this is out of date the second it's printed, but you can see here a little bit of the evolution of the conflict. A couple of different cities, Mariupol and Kherson, where ground fighting is currently happening. I am obviously objectively out of my element in analyzing any of this, but Mariupol in particular, they're saying is strategically very important to Russia, because the forces they're currently moving up through the south and those who have moved into the disputed regions in the east theoretically are cut off by that city. So if they're able to take that, that's gonna be incredibly important. Taking Odessa is theoretically going to stop some of the ability of other countries to get resources in through that port to Ukraine. So those are a couple of the cities that almost certainly are gonna be under a great deal of pressure in the next couple of days.
Yeah, most definitely. And this is where, like, I mean, if you look at that map, you'll see that most of the expansion in the moving forward of like these Russian troops, it's actually in like the southeastern, like southern and eastern portion of Ukraine. And there's a reason for that. There are a lot of strategic thinkers who think that Kiev, in some sense, is a red herring. That's not to say that they're not being occupied. Of course, they're being occupied. But with all the attention in Kiev, it really takes away from the perspective of looking at eastern Ukraine, looking at southern Ukraine, and basically the strategic goal that a lot of people think when it comes to like Russia with Ukraine is connecting the separatist regions in Donetsk and Luhansk to Crimea via land to basically give like an easy route for land-based resources to move from A to B between those regions freely. And that really like is something that is central sort of towards like Russia's economic goals. They have a significant economic interest in making that happen. And so that's why like it really seems like they're expanding a lot further in Eastern Ukraine and Southern Ukraine. And might basically be trying to take those more permanently, even if they do eventually retreat from Kiev.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a good analysis. Let's turn to another angle on this. President Volodymyr Zelensky has been giving regular addresses to the people of Ukraine so that they know what is going on, but also to maintain morale in the face of an absolutely barbaric, brutal invasion. So we want to show you a little bit of the most recent address from the Ukrainian president.
Плани ворога. Плани, які будувалися роками, підло прораховано, з ненавистю до нашої країни. До наших людей, до будь-яких людей, які мають дві речі – свободу і серце. Але ми їх зупинили і б'ємо. Наші військові, наші прикордонники, наша тероборона, навіть прості фермери беруть в полон російських військових щоденно. І вони всі говорять тільки одне – вони не знають, для чого вони тут. Незважаючи на те, що їх у десятки разів більше, моральний стан ворога постійно погіршується. Все більше окупантів втікають назад у Росію від нас, від вас, від усіх, хто виганяє ворога джавелінами, стугнами, гарматами, танками, літаками, гвинтокрилами, усім, що стріляє. Держави – це розгублені діти, яких використали. Заберіть їх додому.
So obviously there's multiple objectives to a speech like that, to reassure the civilians of Ukraine that the military is doing everything they can, to point out the successes where they exist, but also like it's kind of a message not just to the people of Ukraine, but also the people of Russia, like specifically talking about how their soldiers have been lied to and manipulated, hardly unique to this conflict, by the way, but it is certainly true in this conflict. Also, telling them try to be a little bit of an understanding. If you capture people, as has been happening, don't brutalize them. Like these are people who don't necessarily support this war. So I think he's trying to strike a very careful line. And so far in this conflict, I think he's been very successful. The reaction from his people and internationally has been incredibly positive so far. But what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, like one of the things to remember is that there are a lot of like historical and cultural ties between Russia and Ukraine. And so there are quite literally people who have family in like both the Ukrainian military and the Russian military. There are people in the Russian military who have family that are in Ukraine that are civilians that are like trying to defend themselves. And now obviously, right, sort of recruiting all the civilians you can to be part of the military is a risky strategy. Like mistakes are going to be made and yeah, it's going to lead to like a lot of chaos. But one of the things that I think Zelensky knows is that, I mean, war is really a practice in logistics more so than anything else in terms of like strategy, right? And like occupying a country that has an interest in a civilian population, like performing some sort of insurgency basically against the occupying force, it's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult. It's very easy like for, you know, random civilians to sabotage infrastructure and stuff if that's what they're trying to do. And so really that is one of those things that seems to be like the key strategic aspect behind this is basically making sure that morale is boosted enough that the infrastructure and the logistics of the Russian military going into Ukraine is interfered with substantially enough that they can like hold Kiev and keep as many cities as possible from being completely overtaken.
Yeah. Yeah, and definitely to slow it down as much as possible. For which advances a number of different interests. One, they're going to be doing diplomatic overtures. In fact, we're moving now into a second round of talks that are happening right now with an advisor saying that the initial goals from the Ukrainian point of view are a moderate ceasefire and an agreement to establish a humanitarian corridor. So if you are inflicting as much pain on them as possible as they're moving in, maybe they will be a little bit more open to diplomacy. It could go in the other way, but maybe. It provides more time for the international community to provide aid. It provides more time for sanctions to put pressure on Russian industry and oligarchs, who then might, to the extent that they can internally, put pressure on Putin to change course. So there's really no downside, except that a likely consequence will be some civilians who are drafted into this will die. They are not trained soldiers. They could potentially be caught engaging in these sabotage efforts. Engaging in open combat against these forces could result in them dying too, potentially at a high rate. So it seems a little bit like a last ditch effort, but that's what they have at this point.
Yeah, most definitely. And it's just really one of those situations where, like, I mean, it's where, like, a lot of people are like forced into bravery, right? And that's a really, like, it's really a terrible situation, because ultimately, like, if you think about it, if you're just a random person, living in Kiev, right? Like, I mean, do you think everybody's political? Do you think everybody is like deeply invested in the politics between Russia and Ukraine, right? And like the internal politics of like, oh, you know, does Ukraine have a leader that supports Russia or the Western world? You know, what's happening here? No, most people are just trying to live their lives. They're trying to go to the grocery store. They're trying to go to work. And all they're seeing is the Russian military invading their homes. That is all that they see in this. And that, I think, really is the important thing to remember, where like the people that are most impacted by this are just random people who are trying to live their lives, and all of a sudden an army showed up.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. It's so easy, especially for Americans. Everyone sees the people who live in a circumstance that's in any way different than theirs as very hard to imagine, but especially for Americans, because so few of us ever travel abroad or learn about other countries. It's just easy to imagine, like, yeah, well, what was going on in Ukraine before? No, like every normal thing in your life was going on there. I saw, it was, I think it was like in the very immediate aftermath, the invasion being announced. I'm on a subreddit for board games, and there was someone who was asking for advice on whether they should cancel their Dungeons and Dragons session that was coming up in a few days. What would be the safe way to communicate around that? Like, and obviously that seems weird in the context of what's going on, but no, just people are just living their life. They're just trying to live. In all cases, by the way, I know that we're probably gonna get in trouble. It's gonna be a little bit counterproductive to continually remind people that we are not both sides when we say you should care about other refugees. You should care about other people who are being invaded by a massive military power. We also mean it here very much. So let's be clear about that.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I can tell you, I worked with drones. I've seen a lot of things around the world. And I will tell you this, believe it or not, people in Iraq and Afghanistan spend a lot of time taking care of their kids, going to the supermarket, taking their kids to soccer practice, right? You know, doing like all of the normal things that happen also happen in Iraq, Afghanistan. And we did the same thing. We showed up to their homes while they were trying to go to soccer practice. And it's a terrible thing to do. It's terrible.
100%. Really fast, a couple of other quick updates. Credit Suisse was caught trying to shred evidence of loans that they had provided to Russian oligarchs backed by super yachts and private jets. So this is a Swiss credit institute trying to cover up their involvement. They've been offloading risks from its exposure to US sanctioned Russian oligarchs. And so they got caught. Let's keep it real. There's a lot of financial organizations in a lot of countries that have been involved in helping Russian oligarchs to hide their wealth and everything. I look forward in a couple of years to some equivalent to like the Panama Papers or something. For now, understand that as tense and fraught as things are in Ukraine, in a different way, a lot of these banks are trying to figure out how to hide what they've been up to. And related to that, France has actually seized a yacht linked to a Russian oligarch that had been at a port in the Mediterranean. Looks pretty impressive. I think that's the one from that episode of Succession, actually. But anyway, no, I'm kidding. It's a $600 million yacht. And I understand that I'm saying this as a person who, I'm not sure that I've ever been on a yacht, let alone a nice yacht. I'll never own one. You overpaid. Look at it. It's nice. $600 million? How disgustingly, like, counterproductively rich these people are. It ain't worth it. Is it nicer than a regular boat? Yes. Is it 20% nicer? Probably. Is it 6,000 times nicer? No. Don't seize yachts, seize wealth, seize all of it. These people are, they're only doing harm to themselves at this point. And also, I like that we're moving into seizing yachts. Take mansions.
Yeah, take future public housing, okay, public housing, I'm just saying, mm-hmm. right? Like, look, real great opportunity, really easy, you know? And yeah, you're right about the yacht. At a certain point, it's just a bougie apartment, right? Like at a certain point, it's just a bougie apartment that you might get motion sickness in, you know? It sounds real pleasant.
I've always missed that in my apartment. I'm like, I want heated floors in the bathroom and I want the living room to occasionally make me vomit. That's what I want. Well, if you know, rob your country of hundreds of billions of dollars, you too can throw up all over your dining room table. Anyway, I'm glad that this financial pressure is being put on these on the oligarchs, but and this sort of thing especially, because broad-based sanctions obviously can hit regular people. This sort of thing seems less likely to, at least immediately. So I'm glad that they're doing that to these high profile things. Maybe that'll put a little bit of fear into other oligarchs. Now, that said, that's the situation there in Ukraine. How is America gonna process this? What are we gonna be advocating for? Well, we're gonna take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be moving into that territory. Okay, everybody, a bit more on what's going on. How are the American people gonna view Ukraine? We turn to that now. Fox hosts have been scrambling to figure out what exactly are they supposed to be saying about Ukraine and Russia. They had been seemingly perfectly fine with the war before it happened, and then people were horrified by it. So now they're trying to figure out what their message is supposed to be. And it's actually developed into a little bit of a duel between two of their biggest personalities, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, with very different proposed solutions to the problem of what to do about Vladimir Putin. And the gap between their positions is very much life and death. So let's jump into it. Here is Sean Hannity and what he'd like to see happen to the head of Russia.
What we really need in this crisis more than anything else is a worldwide condemnation. And it's a simple new rule that if you invade an innocent sovereign country and you kill innocent men, women, and children, you don't deserve to live. That's the bottom line. Well, Hannity, we have an executive order that prohibits assassination of foreign leaders. And I'm like, you cut the head of the snake off and you kill the snake. And right now the snake is Vladimir Putin. He's killed those young children. He's killed those innocent women. He's injured those innocent citizens. He's caused all of this.
So that is Sean Hannity, who's advocating for a apparently official policy of assassinations, and is not going to be like warded off from that position by the fact that it's illegal, that it's reprehensible, that it would definitely lead to attempts on the lives of other leaders. But anyway, Ben, I did want to ask you. He said that if you invade a country, if you kill men, women, and children, you don't deserve to live. That seems like a safe thing to say because that Vladimir Putin is the only person to which that could be applied, right?
I mean, this is where it gets really wild. Like, look, let's be clear, right? If somebody said this about the American president during the Iraq war, that being George W. Bush, they'd be in Guantanamo right now, right? So like, let's be real that there's a very obvious double standard that is being applied literally right now in the moment, right? I mean, literally the United States just had a drone strike in Somalia, I think 2 days after the war in Ukraine like started, before Russia invaded, right? So like let's just be real, right? And then like there's just ridiculous belief. No, if Vladimir Putin magically tomorrow disappeared, the entire Russian military still exists, right? There are, you know, there are like people that work for Putin, right? Because like, do you really think that one person can magically run an entire country by themselves, right? They need people to run different departments that all have like their own ideas and beliefs, but usually they match the person in charge, right? So like the people that would come in to replace them, you know, like it's very cartoonish. It's very much like, I mean, Sean Hannity thinks this is a movie. He thinks that this is James Bond. He's not living in the real world.
Yeah, exactly. No, well, you nailed it in the it's cartoonish. Sean Hannity apparently Like, look, I watch James Bond movies. I like those things too. I don't generally like try to have that be the like the core foundation of my analysis of world events. But no, he thinks it's as simple as that. Kill Putin. It's not the dumbest thing that he said on his show yesterday. We'll get to that in a little bit. But as I alluded to in the intro, there's a big disagreement. So Hannity is saying kill Putin. They'd had Judith Miller on, who sort of implied that on Fox News a little bit ago. Tucker Carlson wants to go in a different way. So let's jump now what he had to say.
Putin is bad. No one in America is going to argue with that. But will destroying the entire Russian economy make Putin less bad? Will it force Russian troops to withdraw from Ukraine? And if it will, how exactly will that work? And how long will it take? Or is the plan bigger than that? Is the idea that we can force Vladimir Putin from office entirely? Okay, will that work? And if it does work, what happens to Russia after Vladimir Putin leaves? Would the next Russian president be an improvement over Putin? Or would Russia descend into barbarous chaos like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan did once we overthrew their governments? Keep in mind the people, the very people who are proposing all of this are the very same people who defunded our police departments and destroyed our schools and tore down the Teddy Roosevelt statue in New York City. They're the ones who armed the Taliban. They're the ones who devalued the US dollar. They're the ones who brought human slavery back to Libya. They're very good at wrecking things. It's what they do. They planned the Iraq war and they never apologized for it.
We're gonna return to that last point in just a second. But so he's saying, obviously, don't assassinate him, but don't even have as an aspirational goal that he would leave power, which, like, honestly, I'm gonna keep it real. Sometimes people invent a person to hate. I feel like that's what he's doing right now, like inventing a whole bunch of establishment people who are calling for Putin to get taken out, unless that was just a subtweet effectively of Sean Hannity. Most people seem to be focusing on what's happening in Ukraine and stopping the conflict rather than the unique problem of Vladimir Putin. But he's saying there, don't kill him, don't force him out. It might, like, if anything resulted in him leaving office, that might in fact be worse. So you sounded like you share some of those same concerns. What do you think about a post-Putin Russia? Obviously there are other leaders. There is a pro-democracy movement.
Yeah, I mean, it gets complicated, right? Because to a certain degree, one of the things Tucker Carlson said is a little bit correct. Like, we have to give credit where credit is due. I mean, not really. Like, Tucker Carlson is terrible in a litany of other ways. But like, if Putin magically disappeared tomorrow, it would be pretty chaotic. It would be pretty bad. That would be a pretty miserable situation. And do we really want to like intentionally destabilize like a nuclear power? Do we really want to play that game? The irony of this being that the United States is actually sort of responsible for Putin being in power in the first place. A lot of people forget this, but like the United States sort of helped facilitate a coup in the USSR to lead to the dissolving of the USSR, and then actually helped rig elections to make sure that, you know, a capitalist leader came in to replace you know, the existing government. So like the irony here is that like this is happening, you know, three decades after the United States already tried to establish like a more favorable government inside of Russia. And literally, the Ukraine conflict that's happening right now is partially a result of the chaos that was caused by the United States during the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? So the idea that, you know, like intentionally causing like collapse there would somehow make things better, I think is very, very misguided. And yeah, that's just, yeah.
Well, yes, I think that is a serious likelihood. I would say the more immediate issue is, don't openly advocate for world powers to assassinate other leaders.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only can that go in the opposite direction, but like, first of all, Vladimir Putin has shown himself to be perfectly willing to assassinate people. So like, we are trying to create a better world, and it is a complicated path to get there. It is not generally, I think, going to, like, the path doesn't travel through an assassination town. That's not the way that we need to be moving in terms of values. So we'll see how they hash this out. He said there at the end, like, the people who got us into Iraq have never apologized for that. That to me, again, felt like a criticism potentially of Sean Hannity. Also, kind of a criticism of himself, because dude was not an open, you know, was not openly hostile to the Iraq War back in the day. He's again rewriting his history, but these are two of their biggest people on Fox, and they really do seem to disagree about this. Okay, with that, let's now move directly into this.
As of this morning, this 40-mile convoy of Russian troops and Russian tanks and munitions and fuel, they're only 18 miles outside of Kyiv. And let me tell you, when I look at that, I'm thinking, uh-oh, this is about to become, it's about to go to the next level. And I pray to God Almighty I'm wrong. And the next level would be a massacre. And the next level would be the toppling of the government of Kyiv. The next level will mean thousands upon thousands and likely tens of thousands of people dead. And that might be on the low side. That's what I fear the most now. See on satellite imagery where the convoy is. I don't know. Maybe some smart country, maybe NATO might take some of their fighter jets, or maybe they can use some drone strikes and take out the whole damn convoy. And then nobody takes credit for it. So then Putin won't know who to hit back. Well, he's threatening nuclear weapons. Hannity, you talk about nuclear war. I'm not talking about nuclear war, nor would I support one American boot on the ground here. But at what point is this going to end?
There is a case to be made that he might, in fact, be the dumbest person on TV. I don't think that he generally has that reputation. There are some people who are more obviously blowhards and all that. But to be clear, Sean Hannity's plan for the convoy, which we're all incredibly worried about the implications of what that convoy will be used for, is that US or NATO should just attack it and pretend, hey, no, I was totally at the bowling alley. I couldn't have been me. I have an alibi. And he thinks risking open warfare with Russia, he even identifies that nuclear warfare is a possible consequence, but he brushes that off. We'll just say it wasn't us. Ben, what do you think? Did we get away with it? Is it, as Jordan Yule labeled, the perfect crime?
It's just unbelievable. Okay, because like first and foremost, right? Like we can't, there's no way to magically like, oh, you know, like I mean, think about it, okay? Airplanes take off from somewhere. Airplanes take off from somewhere that like everybody can kind of see. And it's not like, like stealth fighter jets. I know we had to explain this to Trump a few years ago. So now I guess we have to explain to Sean Hannity. They're not invisible, right? We don't have invisible planes. That's not a thing, right? You can see planes in the air, even if they're really fast stealth fighter jets. It just means that, you know, like radar can't see them under certain circumstances, right? So like people would get the idea. They would see aircraft leaving like the air bases, right, in like Western Europe, and they could put two and two together there. It's not that complicated, not that difficult.
It's called stealth. Look it up. They're beautiful, or they would be if I could see them. It's
Sean Hannity, like, considers himself an intelligent person. That is such a wildly dangerous thing to suggest. Now, thankfully, Trump is not in power. I don't think Trump would follow the advice in this particular case anyway, but Biden definitely isn't going to. But that is just madness. And look, Hannity saying, let's assassinate Putin, then let's attack his forces. He does have an audience in the millions. They are going to gradually wonder why we're not doing stuff like this. They're going to be frustrated with Biden because he's not being openly hostile enough against a regime that has thousands of nuclear weapons. This is wildly dangerous. Anyway, you could see here, by the way, they have had a good amount of success in Ukraine at destroying vehicles. I don't believe there have been a lot of open attacks on the convoy, but you can see here a shot of a big stretch of vehicles that had in fact been destroyed. And then in the case of the actual convoy, it is believed to have been stalled for some time now, actually. Its advance towards the capital has been much slower than had been predicted a few days earlier. And you know, a lot of credit has been given to the defenders, specifically of Kyiv, saying that they've been putting up very stiff resistance. So again, it's still there. It is still a massive threat. The solution, though, is not open warfare against Russia, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, literally, why bring in like NATO aircraft when you could do something that like a little sugar in a gas tank could do? Like, there's more clever ways to do this, right? Like, and even then, when it comes to the United States' role in this, look, the United States should be trying to de-escalate. There's a lot of things we can do to de-escalate, but that requires, look, that requires sacrifice. Like, let's be real. One of the reasons why they're hesitant on oil and gas sanctions is because, oh, that would mean we all pay a little bit extra at the pump. We would, yeah, it would suck, right? We would have to deal with that in our economy. But like, what is a little bit of an economic sacrifice for the United States and Western Europe when it comes to saving lives in Ukraine, right? We should be like opening up, we should be putting everything on the table. We should be putting everything on the table. I saw somebody on Twitter suggesting, hey, what if we offer to take, you know, nukes out of like some specific countries that are like, you know, that are like new NATO countries as part of the expansion, and we maybe wind down, maybe we make promises about like the Biological Weapons Convention. The United States has been opposing inspections in the Biological Weapons Conventions for years that Russia's been calling for.
That's
so
interesting.
We could say, hey, you know, we should be willing to make sacrifices. We should be willing to make sacrifices to do whatever is necessary to get the Russian troops out of Ukraine.
Yeah. No, I think that those are some interesting ideas. And then it shows that there is a lot of room for creativity. A lot of it is gonna come down to Putin's frame of mind, his perception of how this is going, and the short and long term effects of the sanctions. But as we had said earlier, they are starting talks again. It is possible, maybe, that this could potentially wind down. But we're not gonna get there if NATO starts bombing Russian tanks. That's just Hannity, you just swing and a miss. So that was the reception that anti-trans Texas House candidate Jeff Younger got when he made the horrible decision to go speak at the University of North Texas. I don't know what he expected. It's easy to imagine that people will be chanting something when you speak, but when it's F these fascists, you gone down the wrong road, man. And so Jeff Younger probably regretting that. Apparently, leading up to the video that you saw there, though, he had been seemingly instigating the crowd even more. It was clear that they didn't like him, but he apparently, according to a Twitter thread by Ismail Belkora, says Younger's yelling at the crowd, calling them communists. He called the crowd Russia and then went back to communists. That made a little bit more sense. He said at some point, there is no such thing as a trans person, and this is what leftist politics looks like, which is not generally true. But I wish that was what leftist politics looked like, that it was filled with that much vigor and passion and defense of people under assault in the right wing culture war. Ben, what do you think about this?
I mean, like, I just recently learned I'm a fictional character, everybody. I'm a figment of all of your imaginations. Yeah, like, I'm just a program in the simulation, okay? No, it's just wild. Of course trans people exist. Of course trans people exist. And you love to see like this type of solidarity. This is what's so important, right? Like literally the best thing that you can do when you bump into people, racist, homophobic, transphobic, you name it, is make them feel like they're the only racist person in the world. Make them feel like they're the only transphobic person in the world. Because maybe they'll wake up and realize that they're unpopular for a reason. Maybe perhaps they will be like, wait, am I the bad guy? Because they
am
are.
I?
Yeah.
No, he's not there yet. You know, he at one point said, you guys are perpetually confused. No, they don't seem confused. I don't know them personally. It is possible they're confused about some things. It was at a university. I'm gonna say calculus could be confusing. I don't know. They seem to understand where they stand on this. You seem a little bit confused about a great many things, including the diversity of life experiences that people in our society, as well as notably every other society through the entire history of humanity, has experienced. You don't have the wherewithal or the emotional maturity to educate yourself about these other experiences. And you think it's your job as a state level politician to police these people's lives. And I get why in Texas you would think that. That is apparently the only obligation they feel of their constituents is to go after trans people. But this is him, by the way. We don't show you this for any particular reason, but it's him. Now, he apparently also got attacked by the crowd as being a deadbeat father, because apparently one of the reasons that he decided to run is that he was mad that his ex-wife helping transition their child. So this is not only a position he takes politically that he's wrong for, but he's also on a personal level very wrong in this area too, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, imagine being that hateful. Like literally imagine being that hateful for like a second. Like what, like, cause like think about like the impact on your kid. Like think about the impact on your kid. Like even if you don't understand it, like I wanna be clear. Like I wanna be clear. Like my mom doesn't understand, but my mom is supportive. And that's it. That's like all it takes. It just a little bit of just being supportive. You don't even have to understand. But instead of that, this dude, he's clearly confused. And so he's choosing to literally run for office because he is upset about the existence of like his child not matching his like perfect ideal of what he thinks his kid should be, right? Which I mean, that is like a whole nother thing that right wingers really just want their kids to be like clones of themselves.
Totally.
But like, it's just like, I mean, think about the impact that's gonna have on your kid. Like, why is he not thinking about the relationship that he might wanna have with his child? Instead, he's just too swept up in his own hatefulness in order, like, you know, like, yeah. It's just a damn shame.
It's sad on a personal level. And I can have sympathy for a confused person who has been brought up in a hateful xenophobic culture and has accepted those lessons. When you then act on it, and in particular tried to weaponize the state government to go after these people, as you know, Texas has. They are sending CPS to people's homes. They are searching through medical records. This goes way beyond that. By the way, that event went a little bit beyond the video that you saw. Denton police later confirmed that there was a report of a UNT police officer driving a car into a student who was protesting a speech by Jeff Younger as the car tried to speed away with the organizer of the event inside. So bringing Younger in, bad idea. Not a good sign when you have to like drive as fast as you can out of there. Hitting a kid on your way out is the absolute worst though. Like you gotta have speakers, I guess. You gotta think through this a little bit better. People are allowed to protest. They shouldn't, again, the casual targeting of them with cars, obviously something we've been against for a long time. I hate seeing the violence from kids who are just standing up for what they believe in.
Yeah, and it's just really infuriating how much like violence, like, I mean, cause literally just imagine, right? Like imagine like this situation, somebody says, oh, hey, I'm a girl, right? And your reaction is to get violent about that. Like that is like really condensed at the base level of what it is. They're literally these people who are just so willing to commit acts of violence because they're upset that somebody is a woman or is a man and they're just mad about that. I mean, like it's just really, really baffling the sheer level of like violence they're willing to subject people to, especially like the threat of taking away children from their loving parents. And then, cause who are the parents that they're gonna give those kids to, right? They're probably gonna give those kids to foster care that has a ton of problems. I mean, like they're probably gonna give them to transphobic parents, right? And so like, think about that for like a second, just like the sheer horror. And it's just absolutely, absolutely nightmarish what they're trying to do in Texas right now.
Yes, apparently, by the way, there's relatively new news that the specific investigation of one set of teens has now been blocked by a judge. So that is good. That is effectively when good news happens over the past few years, it is because one judge along the way has stepped in. Unfortunately, we know that anything can make it to the Supreme Court eventually, and we know what that's like. But reminder the Democrats, you are still in power and we still expect you to do your job. You cannot simply hide behind some random judges. Donald Trump may soon be facing even more investigations than he currently is, because the January 6th committee, so those looking into the insurrection, have said that they believe that former President Trump, quote, may have engaged in criminal acts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, according to newly filed court documents. So where did this come from? Well, they were filed in response to attempts by one of Trump's lawyers, John Eastman, who we've spoken about before, to fight a subpoena. They argue that a judge should reject Eastman's attempts to block the subpoena, ordering him to hand over documents, as the normally well-protected privilege between a lawyer and their client, in this case Eastman and Trump, cannot be used if the lawyer and his client are attempting to cover up or engage in a crime. So they sort of have to do this to get access to those documents, and to do it, they need to make the case that there was a crime being covered up. And in particular, in this case, that they knew that they were covering up some sort of crime, and they believe that they have that. And it really comes down to, in addition to some other evidence, one particular email from Eastman to a lawyer for Vice President Mike Pence, where Eastman wrote, "I implore you to consider one more relatively minor violation of the Electoral Count Act to adjourn for 10 days to allow the legislatures to finish their investigations into non-existent voter fraud." They say Eastman knew what he was proposing that it would violate the law, but he nonetheless urged the vice president to take those actions. So that gets into the whole alternate slates and trying to get new votes in that would allow them to overturn the results. But Eastman apparently knew and was willing to communicate via email that that would be a violation of law, but so what, do it anyway. And if that's the case, do they have that normal sort of protection? We're gonna have to see, but what do you make of it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of wild that it's like, I mean, for me, any January 6th, anything, it always just kind of blows my mind that it's, I mean, it's 2022. It's 2022. I feel like all of this should have been done like a year ago, right? Like all of this should have, like, they should have been like pressing a little bit harder on all of these things. And because at a certain point, we're just running up against the clock. We're just running up against the clock to deal with this. And like these people, like the right wingers that believe all of this nonsense, the right wingers, they're trying to like become like election judges and things like that. And they're trying to like, you know, run for office all over the country. And the longer that we take, the more likely it is that new people will get into office that will help protect these people from accountability. And that is just, I feel like there's just a lack of a sense of urgency when it comes to dealing with all of these.
Yeah, I think you are 100% right. I worry about that too. And I worry that the January 6th Commission even sort of understands a bit of that and is doing what they're doing not to achieve the goals that they're saying. So they go on to say that there's a good faith basis for concluding that the president and members of his campaign engaged in a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States. And in particular involved in obstructing an official proceeding of Congress. So they say, okay, we want to get them on these crimes. Do they, like, are they operating with the swiftness, the efficiency that implies that it is important that they do this? Or is it, again, and honestly, this is what some of the right wingers are saying, sort of trying to draw this out in advance of the election because they know the Democrats aren't going to be campaigning on anything. I don't know. I'm not one of those people, so I just get to sit here being frustrated that this is one of many ongoing investigations that it is taking absolutely forever to get even incremental updates on. As with, for instance, Matt Gaetz, who they've been investigating now for like 14 months, they've had his phone. I would love to know if he did it or not. And if he didn't, tell us that too. So I share some of your frustration.
Yeah, 100%. It's just like they really just need to pick up the pace. They need to talk with a sense of urgency. And if this is what Democrats really want to campaign on, then they should actually do something about it, right? Because if they're not going to vote for the bills that we want them to vote for to actually make a difference, they should at least deal with January 6th.
Exactly. Yeah, because that is serious. It might be sort of a campaign scapegoat from their point of view, but for us, I'm very worried about what it implies. And we're actually going to get into a little bit more of that on the other side of this upcoming break. So thank you everyone who joined us for our first hour. We've been having a lot of fun. Hopefully you have too, but the show is not over on Twitch and on YouTube and our members apps. We've got more to break down for you. So we're going to take a couple minute break. Don't go anywhere. Ben and I will be right back. Franklin Sharpslicer says, okay, with a yacht, what are they going to do beside use the bedroom, eat and use the loo? All the rest is unused space. People could squat without a trace. That may be an idea to pursue. Squat and hide. No one will knew. There better be a nice bathroom on a $600 million yacht. Seriously, $600 million. You cannot tell me that you could have more fun with a $600 million yacht than with 600 $1 million yachts. Because then you could be an admiral. You could basically be a pirate. Just give all of those two people, have a massive fleet. How cool would that be?
See, John's been thinking about Waterworld too much. That's what this is.
I do sometimes think about Waterworld, actually. You got me. Anyway.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.